Hello, this is Rob Raccoon.
And this is Jeff.
Great. Well, we'll just wait another minute. It's 3:29, and we welcome everyone who's calling in later on our website. We appreciate your interest, and I've gotten some very nice feedback from people about doing these call-in teas and having the recordings available. So we encourage you, even if you can't call in during the time period of the calls, to email your comments or questions or topics that you would like to see covered during these call-in teas. In fact, maybe I'll start now that it's 3:30 by responding to two emailed questions. One was sent in regarding the technology transfer opportunities and the positive things that are going on in the university systems around the country in terms of new patents and endeavors, especially in the area of biotechnology, nanotechnology, since this is where a lot of university research is focused. New Mexico is not one of the great spenders on higher education, but even so, the Technology Transfer Office has generated about $12 million in revenue in New Mexico by licensing patents that university professors have developed over time. And there's one product that involves cleaning up microbes and another product that's a fuel additive, and they're both supposed to be environmentally friendly. So the one thing about these kind of proactive investments in new technologies is that they tend to be speculative. They require an accreditation, a certain kind of status as a as an investor, and they're very illiquid. So we do some of that here, and if you're interested, please give us a call or shoot us an email. The other emailed question was by one of our clients who travels to Germany and Norway with great frequency, and he was noting that the recent visit by the Italian Prime Minister, the unelected Mario Monti, who came to Finland with a bazooka, saying that the Finns, even though they have contributed to the bailout of Southern Europe, that they really were just self-interested, and the Finns are a very taciturn and polite people, couldn't quite believe that their good deeds were going punished. But it raised the issue that they really have no choice, that the Northern European countries, and especially Germany, have no choice but to bail out the rest of Europe. There are several reasons for that, one of which is that they depend on Southern Europe to buy their exports, much in the same way that China depends on the United States to buy its exports, and that China and China's domestic employment picture, just like Germany's, depends on these exports. So it's not just for social reasons that Germany and the Northern European countries will step up to the plate and swallow their pride to bail out the rest of Southern Europe, but also out of self-interest. So as you read the news or listen to the radio, and there's lots of teeth gnashing and debate about what's to be done, to us it's fairly clear that Germany will agree to finance and to print money and essentially to abrogate their constitution, which prohibits the financing of the debts of other countries, in order to stay part of the European team. And this will involve a change to the Constitution of Germany next year. It's one that the general population would certainly vote down, but the citizens of countries really have very little say in these matters. And I think as we get into the general discussion now about the U.S. stock markets, we'll see that theme repeated. So welcome again to our summer radio call-in commentary. And I'll begin with some general comments about the economy and the markets, and then open it up to questions. The stock market has started up on a rally here in the past month, fueled primarily by a promise of more money being pumped into the system. This is kind of getting to be a tiresome repeat of 2009, or I should say 2010 and 2011, when in the doldrums of the summer months, when the economy looked like it was going to fall back into recession, or there were other negative things going on, the central banks have promised and delivered another round of monetary easing. So when people look at their investment alternatives, as in bank deposits at under 1%, or bond rates under 2 or 3%, there's really a push to invest in higher risk assets, and this is what has sort of turned on the stock markets. You've seen very strong rallies in Europe, even though the basic financial conditions of lack of fiscal discipline haven't changed whatsoever. Still, investors need a return, and so people are moving into risk assets. The fascinating thing to us, and we watch the market also from a technical basis, is that when we turn on the computers in the morning and we look at what's gone on in Europe overnight, we expect and generally see the same magnitude and direction of the market in the U.S. that follows Europe. It's almost as if there's a tacit coordination or cooperation between the market-making forces on both sides of the Atlantic. In addition, there's very little change during the day. There's very little emotionalism in the market. There's very little volume. And this is in part because many individual investors over the last year or two have taken their money out of stocks, out of mutual funds. They've been burned by what they, I think, correctly perceive as an unfair bias in the markets towards the large computerized trading firms. And a lot of people feel like they just don't stand a chance to use their brains or their intuition or whatever, because the market forces are responding to something else. And I think that's essentially true, which is not a good sign for the public's future involvement in the markets. But what we see in the morning is the market going up a certain amount or going down a slight amount, never to any great magnitude, and then basically a flat trading day from there on out. And so it's almost like there's these invisible hands supporting the market, guiding the market, and that those forces, whether they're huge pockets of money in the hands of central banks or hedge funds or sovereign wealth funds, we're not quite sure. But in any event, it's almost like people are really afraid of what might happen if the reality of the, let's say, the high unemployment rates, which the employment numbers have come out, they're slightly positive. Employment numbers are notoriously susceptible to manipulation and restatement later on in the month or the quarter, so I'm not really sure why people pay much attention to them. The chronic or steady unemployment rate has gone from around 5% up to 8%, which translates into about 5 million jobs that have been lost due to the contraction, the financial kind of meltdown in 2007, 2008. 5 million jobs have not come back and are unlikely to come back in the U.S. in the service sector, management sector, public service sector. There certainly are jobs available for people who are trained in technical areas. That doesn't really translate into retraining opportunities for many people who've been laid off from the financial industry or the real estate or the construction industry, and so on and so forth. So there's a mismatch between the needs of American industry and the educational capacities or skill level experience of most people who are unemployed. And we're not quite sure where that goes, but it's likely that the demographics of the United States, which are really the key factors in terms of long-term market trends, are such that people who are nearing retirement, people, or actually people who have retired, who are living on fixed incomes, are certainly being hurt by low interest rates and sort of very mediocre stock market returns. Those people have retired. They're disappointed in the returns that the markets are providing, but they'll probably be okay. On the other hand, people in their late 40s, 50s, early 60s are looking at, and seeing their savings accounts not really performing like they had expected or had been promised to, according to the projections of state retirement fund managers or pension funds or insurance companies. And so the realization of people, kind of middle-aged people, is that they're likely going to have to continue working far past the age of their parents, far past the 60s, you know, when Social Security might kick in. And due to the fact that this age range of people will work indefinitely, it means that the younger working people in their 30s and early 40s are unlikely to see the kinds of opportunities for advancement, because there's this overhang of working of older working people who just can't afford to retire. And that means that entry-level jobs for people in their 20s, people graduating college, are just not there in any great numbers. So it's kind of like the whole employment situation has gotten bogged down. And that combined with the tendency of Americans to try and pay down their debts so that the experience of losing homes or getting behind the eight ball with consumer debt doesn't reoccur. So we have this kind of deleveraging effort on the part of individuals, which has hurt consumer spending. And then we have this demographic backlog of workers, all of which says that the savings rate should be going up, even though the investment returns are going down. I guess people perceive, again, correctly, that they need to save more if they are going to retire or put away a rainy day fund. The other main issue is what does all this mean for the markets in terms of a stagnant employment situation, lower interest rates, because it's in the government's best interest to keep rates low. Obviously, if we have a certain deficit and we're paying a lot of interest on our deficit, if rates were to move up to a more normal rate, let's say they went from 3% to 5%, the interest expense would just go through the roof, and there would have to be an acknowledgement that the United States is actually in a similar situation as France and Spain and Italy, in the sense that the level of debt is really not able to be paid off by current domestic production. We're not in that situation. The United States in particular has an advantage of being the world's reserve currency, so that there's a demand for dollars, and foreign countries, foreign individuals perceive, rightfully so, that the United States has a very stable investment environment. And so we continue to attract capital from around the world, especially as the turmoil in Europe ramps up. And we get the benefit of that in terms of lower interest rates, so that we can continue to borrow at a low cost. And that's very helpful to the government and the markets in terms of providing ballast. So I think that the rest of the year, the rest of 2012, looks fairly positive for the stock market and even the bond market, because of the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank and the special facilities that have been set up to sort of move loans around between shell companies. That's essentially what's going on in terms of how they're avoiding, you know, calling a spade, that Greece is bankrupt, that Spain is in a depression, that the mechanisms by which the governments are able to do that will provide a lot of impetus for people to continue to put money in the stock market, at least the institutions. And the earnings capacity of companies is certainly diminished due to the decreased power of consumers in Europe and the U.S. For different reasons. But there are many multinational companies who are able to take advantage of the increasing wealth of people in the emerging markets in Asia, in Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, in Latin America, some of those economies are doing quite well, and that the companies are able to adjust to these sort of difficult political situations to pay dividends and do fairly well. That's one of our approaches. It's not a new approach, or certainly exclusive to our firm, but we're finding that as the news in Europe gets worse, that some of the companies over there get to be better and better bargains, and we know that their basic business operations are diversified outside of Europe. And European companies tend to pay higher dividends. They tend to pay their executives less than U.S. companies, and to pay back their shareholders at a higher level, which is something that our clients like due to the need for current income and cash flow. So we've been looking at companies based in Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and so forth. Let me finish up the sort of general overview by talking about the energy sector. The price of oil is down considerably, partially due to the outlook for the global economy as ratcheting down, as China's growth has slowed, as Europe has gone into what I consider to be a depression, as I said before. And so there are other reasons why the price of energy is down. In the U.S., the stockpiling of energy has gone up, and it looks like if we continue on this trend, that the U.S. will effectively be energy independent from Middle Eastern oil within the next decade. That's something that a lot of people think is important, and looks like it's going to happen with new drilling techniques and the conversion of a lot of industrial plants and even vehicles to the use of natural gas. Natural gas has started to move up in price, which we're happy to see, not just because New Mexico is a main producer of natural gas, but because it's a clean domestic energy source. And so America looks to be in fairly good shape energy-wise. Interesting to note that China, which has far outstripped its own domestic productive capacities, has been buying energy companies in Canada this last quarter. And so the Chinese, who are very long-term savvy and strategic investors, are now taking their surpluses that they're earning through their manufacturing exports and reinvesting those monies in different resource-based economies in Canada, as I mentioned, also in Africa. They're diversifying, and probably a smart move on their part. At this point, I think I would like to open up the floor if there's anyone on the phone or anyone wants to email me any questions. Let's see what's up.
Well, you touched on Europe and some of the things happening there. One of the questions always is, what about Greece?
What about Greece? Well,
is it going to stay part of the group or not?
You know, if people were to acknowledge the financial condition of Greece, it would look a little bit like, I don't know, the city of Stockton, California, looks to the United States. The city of Stockton and a couple of other towns in California have declared bankruptcy and stopped paying on their bonds. Greece has stopped paying on their bonds. The only way they make payments for show is to be able to borrow money from the other facilities in Europe. And so there's an acknowledgement that Greece is bankrupt, but I think for political purposes, which turn out to be more important than economic reasons, the European powers do not want Greece to leave the European Union, because the implication would be that Portugal might leave. And if Portugal were to leave, then Spain might leave. And so it's that old theory of dominoes that we used to subscribe to in the 50s about communist takeovers, that if one small country goes communist, then the next one will go and the next one. So I do not believe that Greece will exit the European Union. I think there's an unlimited capacity of political leaders and economic institutions to lie about the reality of the situation so as to maintain the semblance of normal conditions so that people don't freak out and just start selling bonds. If you actually look at the capital in Europe, at bank deposits, over half of Greek assets of people in Greece who actually have savings have taken their savings out of Greece already and moved them to other countries. What you're seeing in the last month is you're seeing people taking assets out of Europe as a whole. Spain has seen essentially a run on their banks. You won't read about any of this because it's like calling the economic conditions a depression. When you say something's in the depression, then people get depressed and other things get worse. And that is very true about capital flight. We are experiencing a capital flight out of Europe and not just out of Greece and Portugal, but out of Spain and Italy as well. We're starting to see that people take money out of Germany and France, which is sort of the end game You know, France is in very, very bad financial condition, but no one will talk about it because they and Germany are seen as the two largest demographic industrial powers, which they are. Germany happens to earn money, and France happens to borrow money. And, you know, that goes hand in glove. But that is the potential Achilles heel of all of the political maneuverings of the central banks and the politicians in Europe, is that if enough capital leaves and it becomes public knowledge somehow that that's happening, then the confidence in the markets goes down, and then there's kind of a repeat on a larger scale of the lack of confidence that, that happened when Lehman Brothers failed in 07, that people stopped trusting each other, and the central banks, doesn't really matter how much money they print, people still don't want to lend to those countries. So it's pretty thin ice that we're skating on. Greece happens to be a very small portion of the European economy, like a little town in California is to the United States. But they really don't want the news of Greece's real financial condition to get out there and be talked about. And so that's why they essentially have no choice but to bail Greece out, no matter what it takes. And all of the talk about austerity and budget discipline and this and that, and the sale of country assets, there are superficial things that they do to show that they're trying to comply with it, but none of it is meaningful relative to the size of the problem. A corollary question would be, you know, what can you invest in that can offset the risks of that kind of scenario that I just sketched out? And the typical investment strategy is gold and metals or commodities, natural resource-based companies. And in fact, those kinds of investments have actually gone down in price over the last 12 months. Which is, say, well, why would that be if the economic conditions are getting worse? Why would the things that do well when the economy is bad or sort of there's an imminent devolvement in financial conditions? And the answer is that, the Chinese economy has slowed down, and so there isn't as much surplus wealth in China that is chasing commodities or gold. And the second reason is that the authorities really who can control the spot market, the publicly traded market for gold, have probably found a way to hold the price of gold steady. It's a lot like what I started talking about when we look at the stock market, how it goes up a very moderate amount and then stays steady the whole day. Gold is exhibiting the kind of price stability that is just not normal. It just doesn't feel right, like it's a reflection of reality. And the other day I was talking with some people, some investment people who travel around the world, who really believe strongly in gold, and they said to me, you know, if you go to Europe and you go to buy actual gold, you can't find it. There's a dearth of supply. So if the price of the actual metal, the physical metal, was translated into the spot price that's used for the public markets, gold might actually be moving up. And so it's my sort of intuitive feeling that the same hands that are steadying the stock market and keeping interest rates low also have a stake in keeping the price of gold fairly steady, so that there's not a kind of a rolling snowball effect that picks up power as it goes along. And so that's pretty much my take on Greece.
Rob?
Yes.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, this is Katie in Boulder. Continuing on your gold comment, I think you had mentioned one other time about gold actually being sold as a paper product and not the actual gold.
Yes.
Yes, say more about that. I still need to learn more.
Yes. Yes, it's a very fascinating topic and one that relates to the mortgage problems that created the financial meltdown. What's happened over the last 5 or 10 years is that the big investment banks have created what are essentially electronic contracts. They're the term derivatives doesn't really mean much, except that it's not the actual metal. Just like when people were buying what they thought were AAA mortgages, in fact, what they were buying was a piece of paper or an electronic document that depended on a bank or several banks to make good on their contracts between themselves. And it was all based on the fact that somewhere there was a true mortgage behind all of it. Now, in fact, the true mortgages had been sliced up. You could take, you know, your mortgage on a house in Boulder and divide it into the first 5 years, the second 5 years, the third 5 years, and then divide it into the principal payments and the interest payments. And if it was a variable rate mortgage that you had on your house in Boulder, it could be divided into different interest rates on your variable rate. So out of your one personal mortgage, it might be involved in, let's say, 10 different mortgage-backed securities or derivatives. Now, that can sound complicated because it is. No one really understands the interaction between if someone stops paying on their mortgage, which of the contract holders gets hurt first, which is what it was all based on, all of those sales. If you take that analogy of an investment bank creating a very complex product based on something that's real in the world and apply it to gold, the same thing is true. You take a bank like Barclays, the one that was indicted or punished recently for its manipulation of interest rates, or you take an investment firm like BlackRock in New York that owns these financial contracts, that actually writes them and issues them and makes a market in them. The largest claim on physical gold in the world is made under a financial contract that BlackRock owns. Now, if everyone who owned this paper contract, a derivative contract on gold, asked for their metal, it couldn't possibly be delivered because there's like 6 or 7 times as many contracts as there are physical gold. So when you buy, and this is the most common way that people own gold, is they buy what's called an exchange-traded fund. And it looks like a stock, it smells like a stock, it supposedly acts like a stock, it's held in a brokerage firm like a stock. But all it is is an agreement between parties to deliver gold, which essentially is untrue. It cannot physically be true. It could not be carried out, the execution of that contract. Now, that doesn't matter to anyone as long as there's not a run on turning your contract into the real metal. It would matter a great deal if enough people did it at once, just like it matters to a bank if their depositors come in and they all want their deposits at the same time. They just can't do it. And so they'd shut down. And that is certainly possible when it comes to gold and these contracts, these exchange-traded funds. So our goal is to move people out of those very convenient, very cheap, very tax-efficient vehicles. They have all the right things to say about them, accept the fact that they're not real gold, into either the gold bullion itself, which you can order, or there are mutual funds that actually physically have a one-to-one ratio of the number of mutual fund shares that they issue and the gold that they have physically in their possession. So, Katie, does that give you too much information or not enough?
That was great. I appreciate that.
Good, good. This whole exchange-traded fund universe also exists relative to stocks, to things like the Standard & Poor's 500. And again, they are used by very intelligent people. They're used very widespreadly, and they work as long as the markets are working. But when you have a computer generated trading crisis like we did last May, and there was a very small one on August 1st, where one company, their computers went crazy, and in the matter of 10 minutes, the market, the large cap U.S. market was down by 10%. It wasn't that the companies had anything wrong with them. It was just a computer-generated kind of meltdown, a mini meltdown, like a mini stroke. And they got that fixed, but it just shows that these derivative contracts are very susceptible to computerized trading manipulation or errors or whatever. And so we think it's important to move away from those. We're in the minority, that's for sure, and that's okay with me. That gives us more time to actually get that accomplished. Let's see if there's one more question that we can answer before everyone gets bored and goes to sleep.
Well, we're not sleeping.
Good. Let's talk a little bit about the real estate market. That question was asked yesterday at our client tea here in Santa Fe about the advisability of investing in real estate as an investment. And my response was that real estate is a very localized and situation-specific investment. There are ways to invest in real estate generically through publicly traded stocks, real estate investment trusts. And 3 or 4 years ago, when the market was melting down, we bought a fair number of those, and they've done quite well. I'm not a believer in buying any more of those because I think there are so many investors out there who need income that they've kind of flocked to anything that looks like it has a high cash flow, and that has bid the price of those publicly traded stocks up. On the contrary, there are small situations that we are researching, both in terms of acquiring actual pieces of real estate or in lending to real estate developers who have a good track record and ample collateral. And so we are pursuing definitely real estate opportunities in what we consider to be good cash flow localized environments. And by that, I mean places like the Bay Area, Brooklyn, New York, San Diego, and in the moderate price range where people are not looking for huge properties. They're not looking for high overhead in terms of heating costs, and we're looking for properties that have relatively easy access to medical facilities, because that is clearly one of the growing parts of the U.S. economy as the population ages, is access to good medical care. And so when we can put together kind of that package of attributes, we're very interested in pursuing real estate opportunities on a case-by-case basis. There are areas that are kind of out of sight. They're going crazy, like Manhattan, or I just read about a sale in Miami because of the tremendous amount of wealth that's being generated in Latin America. And so there are pockets of extreme wealth that are essentially price inelastic. They don't care how much things cost. That's far too rich for my blood. On the other hand, there are areas that will likely never come back. For example, here in Santa Fe, there's a very kind of posh golf community that's outside of town that was overbuilt. And it's a very pleasant place for people to live if they have horses or they like to play golf. And they don't worry about selling their property in 10 or 15 years. But because the average size home out there is 5,000 square feet, and it's pretty darn cold here in Santa Fe during the winter, and it costs quite a bit to heat those homes, the number of people who are looking for second homes with those characteristics, I think, it goes down and doesn't come back really ever. And so that's what's got a number of the local banks here in New Mexico kind of tied up in a bad financial condition, and we try and stay away from those kinds of situations. So let's see if there are any final questions from anyone on the phone. If not, I'll thank you for joining us, and we'll continue to be optimistic about making our way through these markets. We're definitely interested in buying good companies that pay high dividends and watching them to make sure they don't get caught sideways in all these kind of different drafts, political and economic drafts. So thanks again for joining us, and until next time, adieu, adieu, adieu.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.